Chapter 20. Of fashion, and could only procure a room between us, at the German house, where you find English comfort, says the advertisement, with German prices. But oh, the English comfort of those beds! How did Lankin manage in his, with his great long legs? How did I toss, and tumble in mine, which, small as it was, I was not destined to enjoy alone, but to pass the night in company with anthropophagous wretched reptiles, who took their horrid meal off an English Christian. I thought the morning would never come, and when the tardy dawn at length arrived, and as I was in my first sleep, dreaming of Miss Fanny, behold I was wakened up by the sergeant, already dressed and shaven, and who said, "Rise, Titmarsh, the steamer will be here in 3/4 of an hour. And the modest gentleman retired, and left me to dress. The next morning we had passed by the rocks and towers, the old familiar landscapes, the gleaming towns by the riverside, and the green vineyards combed along the hills, and when I woke up, it was at a great hotel at Cologne, and it was not sunrise yet. Dutz lay opposite, and over Dutz the dusky sky was reddened. The hills were veiled in the mist and the gray. The gray river flowed underneath us. The steamers were roosting along the quays, a light keeping watch in the cabins here and there, and its reflections quivering in the water. As I look, the skyline towards the east grows redder and redder. A long troop of gray horsemen winds down the river road, and passes over the bridge of boats. You might take them for ghosts, those gray horsemen, so shadowy do they look. But you hear the trample of their hoofs as they pass over the planks. Every minute the dawn twinkles up into the twilight, and over Dutz the heaven blushes brighter. The quays begin to fill with men. The carts begin to creak and rattle, and wake the sleeping echoes. Ding, 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 the steamer's bells begin to ring. The people on board to stir and wake. The lights may be extinguished, and take their turn of sleep. The active boats shake themselves, and push out into the river. The great bridge opens, and gives them passage. The church bells of the city begin to clink. The cavalry trumpets blow from the opposite bank. The sailor is at the wheel, the porter at his burden, the soldier at his musket, and the priest at his prayers. Dot dot dot, and lo! In a flash of crimson splendor, with blazing scarlet clouds running before his chariot, and heralding his majestic approach, God's sun rises upon the world, and all nature wakens and brightens. O glorious spectacle of light and life! O beatific symbol of power, love, joy, beauty! Let us look at thee with humble wonder, and thankfully acknowledge and adore. What gracious forethought is it, what generous and loving provision, that deigns to prepare for our eyes, and to soothe our hearts with such a splendid morning festival. For these magnificent bounties of heaven to us, let us be thankful, even that we can feel thankful, for thanks surely is the noblest effort, as it is the greatest delight, of the gentle soul, and so, a grace for this feast, let all say who partake of it. See, the mist clears off Drachenfels, and it looks out from the distance, and bids us a friendly farewell. Farewell to holiday and sunshine. Farewell to kindly sport and pleasant leisure. Let us say goodbye to the Rhine, friend. Fogs, and cares, and labor are awaiting us by the Thames, and a kind face or two looking out for us to cheer, and bid us welcome. The Rose and the Ring. A Fireside Pantomime for Great and Small Children. By Mr. M. A. Titmarsh. Prelude. It happened that the undersigned spent the last Christmas season in a foreign city, where there were many English children. In that city, if you wanted to give a child's party, you could not even get a magic lantern, or buy Twelfth Night characters, those funny painted pictures of the king, the queen, the lover, the lady, the dandy, the captain, and so on, with which our young ones are wont to recreate themselves at this festive time. My friend Miss Bunch, who was governess of a large family that lived in the piano noble of the house inhabited by myself, and my young charges, it was the Palazzo Pugna Disci at Rome, and Messrs. Spillman, T. Two of the best pastry cooks in Christendom have their shop on the ground floor, colon Miss Bunch, I say, begged me to draw a set of Twelfth Night characters for the amusement of our young people. She is a lady of great fancy and droll imagination, and having looked at the characters, she and I composed a history about them, which was recited to the little folks at night, and served as our fireside pantomime. Our juvenile audience was amused by the adventures of Giglio and Bulbo, Rosalba, and Angelica. I am bound to say the fate of the hall porter created a considerable sensation, and the wrath of Countess Gruffanuff was received with extreme pleasure. If these children are pleased, thought I, why should not others be amused also? In a few days Dr. Birch's young friends will be expected to reassemble at Rodwell Regis, where they will learn everything that is useful, and under the eyes of careful ushers continue the business of their little lives. But, in the meanwhile, and for a brief holiday, let us laugh, and be as pleasant as we can. And you elder folk a little joking, and dancing, and fooling will do even you no harm. The author wishes you a Merry Christmas, and welcomes you to the Fireside Pantomime. M.A. Titmarsh. December 1854. The Rose and the Ring, I shows how the royal family sat down to breakfast. This is Valoroso XXIV, King of Paphlagonia, seated with his queen and only child at their royal breakfast table, and receiving the letter which announces to his majesty a proposed visit from Prince Bulbo, heir of Padella, reigning king of Crim Tartary. Remark the delight upon the monarch's royal features. He is so absorbed in the perusal of the King of Crim Tartary's letter, that he allows his eggs to get cold, and leaves his August muffins untasted. What? That wicked, brave, delightful Prince Bulbo! Cries Princess Angelica. So handsome, so accomplished, so witty the conqueror of Rumbombamento, where he slew 10,000 giants. Who told you of him, my dear? Asks his majesty. A little bird, says Angelica. Poor Giglio, says Mama, pouring out the tea. Bother Giglio, cries Angelica, tossing up her head, which rustled with a 1,000 curl papers. I wish, growls the king, wish Giglio was. Dot was better? Yes, dear, he is better, says the queen. Angelica's little maid, Betsinda, told me so when she came to my room this morning with my early tea. You are always drinking tea, said the monarch, with a scowl. It is better than drinking porter brandy and water, replies her majesty. Well, well, my dear, I only said you were fond of drinking tea, said the king of Paphlagonia, with an effort, as if to command his temper. Angelica, I hope you have plenty of new dresses. Your milliner's bills are long enough. My dear queen, you must see, and have some parties. I prefer dinners, but of course you will be for balls. Your everlasting blue velvet quite tires me. And, my love, I should like you to have a new necklace. Order one. Not more than 100 or 150,000 pounds. And Giglio, dear? Says the queen. Giglio may go to the... Oh, sir! Screams her majesty. Our own nephew. Our late king's only son. Giglio may go to the tailors, and order the bills, to be sent into Glomboso to pay. Confound him. I mean bless his dear heart. He need want for nothing. Give him a couple of guineas for pocket money, my dear, and you may as well order yourself bracelets, while you are about the necklace, Mrs. V. Her Majesty, or Mrs. V, as the monarch facetiously called her, for even royalty will have its sport, and this august family were very much attached, embraced her husband, and, twining her arm round her daughter's waist, they quitted the breakfast room in order to make all things ready for the princely stranger. When they were gone, the smile that had lighted up the eyes of the husband and father fled the pride of the king, fled the man was alone. Had I the pen of A.G. P. R. James, I would describe Valoroso's torments in the choicest language, in which I would also depict his flashing eye, his distended nostril, his dressing gown, pocket handkerchief, and boots. But I need not say I have not the pen of that novelist. Suffice it to say, Valeroso was alone. He rushed to the cupboard, seizing from the table one of the many egg cups with which his princely board was served for the matin meal, drew out a bottle of Right Nancer cognac, filled and emptied the cup several times, and laid it down with a hoarse, ha, now Valeroso is a man again. But oh, he went on, still sipping, I am sorry to say, ere I was a king, I needed not this intoxicating draught. Once I detested the hot brandy wine, and quaffed no other fount but nature's rill. It dashes not more quickly o'er the rocks than I did, as, with blunderbuss in hand, I brushed away the early morning dew, and shot the partridge, snipe, or antlered deer. Ah! Well may England's dramatist remark, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Why did I steal my nephews, my young giglios? Steal, said I? No, not steal. Let me withdraw that odious expression. I took, and on my manly head I set, the royal crown of Paphlagonia. I took, and with my royal arm I wield, the sceptral rod of Paphlagonia. I took, and in my outstretched hand I hold, the royal orb of Paphlagonia. Could a poor boy, a sniveling, driveling boy was in his nurse's arms but yesterday, and cried for sugar plums and puled for pap bear up the awful weight of crown, orb, scepter? Gird on the sword my royal fathers wore, and meet in fight the tough Crimean foe? And then the monarch went on to argue in his own mind, though we need not say that blank verse is not argument, that what he had got it was his duty to keep, and that, if at one time he had entertained ideas of a certain restitution, which shall be nameless, the prospect by a certain marriage of uniting two crowns, and two nations which had been engaged in bloody and expensive wars, as the Paphlagonians and the Crimeans had been, put the idea of Giglio's restoration to the throne out of the question. Nay, were his own brother, King Savio, alive, he would certainly will the crown from his own son in order to bring about such a desirable union. Thus easily do we deceive ourselves. Thus do we fancy what we wish is right. The king took courage, read the papers, finished his muffins and eggs, and rang the bell for his prime minister. The queen, after thinking whether she should go up and see Giglio, who had been sick, thought, not now. Business first, pleasure afterwards. I will go and see dear Giglio this afternoon, and now I will drive to the jeweler's, to look for the necklace and bracelets. The princess went up into her own room, and made Betsinda, her maid, bring out all her dresses. And as for Giglio, they forgot him as much as I forget what I had for dinner last Tuesday 12th. 2. How King Valeroso got the crown, and Prince Giglio went without. Paphlagonia, 10 or 20,000 years ago, appears to have been one of those kingdoms where the laws of succession were not settled. For when King Savio died, leaving his brother regent of the kingdom, and guardian of Savio's orphan infant, this unfaithful regent took no sort of regard of the late monarch's will, had himself proclaimed sovereign of Paphlagonia under the title of King Valeroso XXIV, had a most splendid coronation, and ordered all the nobles of the kingdom to pay him homage. So long as Valeroso gave them plenty of balls at court, plenty of money and lucrative places, the Paphlagonian nobility did not care who was king, and as for the people, in those early times, they were equally indifferent. The Prince Giglio, by reason of his tender age at his royal father's death, did not feel the loss of his crown and empire. As long as he had plenty of toys and sweetmeats, a holiday 5 times a week, and a horse and gun to go out shooting when he grew a little older, and, above all, the company of his darling cousin, the king's only child, poor Giglio was perfectly contented. Nor did he envy his uncle the royal robes and scepter, the great hot uncomfortable throne of state, and the enormous cumbersome crown in which that monarch appeared from morning till night. King Valeroso's portrait has been left to us, and I think you will agree with me that he must have been sometimes rather tired of his velvet, and his diamonds, and his ermine, and his grandeur. I shouldn't like to sit in that stifling robe with such a thing as that on my head. No doubt, the queen must have been lovely in her youth, for though she grew rather stout in after life, yet her features, as shown in her portrait, are certainly pleasing. If she was fond of flattery, scandal, cards, and fine clothes, let us deal gently with her infirmities, which, after all, may be no greater than our own. She was kind to her nephew, and if he had any scruples of conscience about her husband's taking the young prince's crown, consoled herself by thinking that the king, though a usurper, was a most respectable man, and that at his death Prince Giglio would be restored to his throne, and share it with his cousin, whom he loved so fondly. The prime minister was Glumboso, an old statesman, who most cheerfully swore fidelity to King Valoroso, and in whose hands the monarch left all the affairs of his kingdom. All Valoroso wanted was plenty of money, plenty of hunting, plenty of flattery, and as little trouble as possible. As long as he had his sport, this monarch cared little how his people paid for it. He engaged in some wars, and of course the Paphlagonian newspapers announced that he had gained prodigious victories. He had statues erected to himself in every city of the empire, and of course his pictures placed everywhere, and in all the print shops. He was Valoroso the Magnanimous, Valoroso the Victorious, Valoroso the Great, and so forth. For even in these early times courtiers and people knew how. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.